House Committee on Revenue for May 23rd, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we have several bills to deal with today. I want to announce first that we're holding House Bill 2047 over until tomorrow. So we take that one off our agenda for today. I want to open for work House Bill 2745. We'll do that. We want to hear from our legislative counsel on a question that came up during the discussion, I think yesterday, about the issue of bonding. And Representative Bueller, would you mind repeating your question? I can probably get it, but I think you're more likely to be able to say it the way you want to than I can.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Roughly the conversation was around if there's a default on the bonds from the transit district or the COIC equivalent, then who ultimately holds that liability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. So the what you're doing in this bill, in effect, is creating a new kind of special district. And potentially you're authorizing that entity to issue bonds that will be general obligation property tax bonds, which means they become what's being pledged is stream of revenue based on the value of the property in this territory of the district. So and unlike other property taxes, once authorized by voters, those remain as a lien against the property until paid. So they go into the mix of the property tax system, and if unpaid, become ultimately can lead to a foreclosure on particular parcels of property. But what's being pledged is essentially the value of the property. Does that help answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, follow up.
Please, yeah.
Yep. And if there wasn't a functioning government, so we've heard in this committee recently of the concept of a zombie government, which is a new term to me, meaning there wasn't an entity to collect the taxes in that entity. In this situation, what would occur then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, so as I said, they'd be a part of the property tax mix, so they would actually be collected by the various, my understanding is a multi-county entity, what's envisioned, but they would be collected by the various county property tax assessors as part of the property tax assessment process, and would go into what's called the unsegregated tax collections account for each county and would be distributed out. And let's see, would be distributed out to the ultimately to the bondholders as payment for interest.
So let me just run through a hypothetical here. So let's say Jefferson County, just for sake of modeling here, Jefferson County stopped having a functional property tax collection system where they don't have an assessor, they don't have someone to enforce the taxes. And there's concern on the default of the bonds. Would that mean that Deschutes County would then have to take over responsibility for collecting those taxes?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, the answer is no. The property tax system, it is, while it is administered at the large parts of it are administered at the county level, the Department of Revenue has oversight over that system and actually requires assessment offices to be managed to a certain level that would allow for that collection.
So the ultimate holder, the responsibility for collecting then would be the State Department of Revenue. If we lost a functioning Jefferson County assessor and enforcement of the property tax?
Yes, it would, but it's much broader than this particular example. That would be just one of a number of taxes. The property tax system is where you combine various local government taxes into a uniform assessment process. So if for some reason Jefferson County was unable to perform that function, the Department of Revenue would step in and at least pay for that function to be performed.
That's what I wanted to know.
Okay. Great. Any other questions for Dexter? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your help this afternoon.
Thank you.
So what's your pleasure? We're really short of people. I don't know.
Let me take my team outside.
Okay, we'll stand at ease. Committee will come back to order. We're in the work session on House Bill 2745. Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, is there an amendment, or is it just 2745A?
Is there an amendment? Oh, yeah, that's A3. Right. There is an amendment, the A3 amendment, which we talked about yesterday. Let's make sure we know what we're doing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have the A3 amendment, which was discussed at yesterday's hearing.
And we have the paperwork for the A3 amendment.
But we have the paperwork now, so the fiscal impact is a no impact, and the revenue impact statement, of course, as this is more or less permissive to the intergovernmental entity to impose these taxes, there's no direct impact. We always flag that this could possibly impact Measure 5 compression when you allow for another district, but otherwise no impact on both the revenue and the fiscal side of things the A3.
And my recollection is that the amendment simply clarifies the process and the rules involving the vote of the people on these bond measures and such, and the operating budgets.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It added the only language. It strengthened, I guess you could say, some of the language that was in the A2 in the previous, and then there is some more language about reporting annual report and annual audit. So that's some of the new language in the bold in the A3.
Is Representative Huffman still here?
Yes.
Oh. Want to come and talk about the A3 with us for a second?
could
sure.
Your counselor join?
Yeah. We missed your commentary yesterday, so we thought we'd better get it today.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. John Huffman, State Representative for House District 59, which includes a large portion of Central Oregon.
And the question is the A3 amendment. We got a description of it yesterday from the other witness, but I think given that we have a lot of things on our plate, it would be useful to hear your summary of the A3 amendment and how it improves the bill and what your current thoughts are about it.
Well, Chair Barnhart, thanks for the question. I have, being the intelligent representative that I am, have stayed out of the problem. What I've rather tried to do is make sure that all of the Central Oregon entities that this is going to impact has been at the table, talking about it, had a voice, and that's why this late in the game, you'll recall we took about a 2 or 3 week recess working with you and Mr. Warner on trying to make sure that we had the right final amendment come through, and it came through yesterday morning. Eric Kanzler has worked a lot with Dexter Johnson on and the stakeholders to make sure this is exactly right. They all signed off yesterday morning, and so therefore I was a happy guy.
Okay. Thank you. I think those are...
That's the technical part of the story, sir.
That is the correct answer, too, when you're in the spot that we often are in on a bill that we sponsor. Did you have anything to add?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler, Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council in the city of Bend for the purposes of today. So I think that staff put it well, saying that what the dash A3 represents is a number of steps that would essentially strengthen the administration of the powers outlined in this bill. We heard from a number of folks throughout the community, including chambers of commerce and economic development interests, that they wanted to make sure that, among other things, local governments and the transit provider had the mechanisms in place to maintain regular contact, to share decision-making, so that they didn't lose any local control. That was one of the primary elements and imports of the A3, is to make sure that, you know, that there will be a locally appointed citizens advisory committee. There will be annual reporting and transparency and things of that nature. That's what the A3 gets at.
Right.
And Chair Barnhart, my folks said, as long as the bill doesn't get changed, as long as we maintain control of our own destiny in Sisters or Jefferson County or whatever local government it is, then they were good, because they understand the need for a comprehensive transit system.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Are we ready?
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Representative Benz, please.
Chair, I move the A3 amendments to House Bill 2745.
Representative Benz moves the A3 amendments to House Bill 2745. Is there discussion? Objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move House Bill 2745A as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2745A as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Objections to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Thank you. Representative Huffman, will you carry? Thank you. Representative Huffman will carry, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2745 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2377. That's yours?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2377A, it is a measure that is creating a permissive property tax exemption, and it's for multi-unit rehabilitated or newly constructed property. It allows this property tax exemption for up to 10 consecutive years, and again, this is permissive, so it's requiring the city or a county to establish the exemption by ordinance or resolution, and in that ordinance, it would include a schedule for the number of years in which the property will be exempt and the amount of the exemption, and that is to be based directly related to the percentage of the units that are rented at monthly rates that are affordable to households with annual income at or below 80% of the area median income. It does have language that is certainly familiar probably to the committee of requiring local government districts equal to the 51% threshold of the tax that's being imposed on the property to essentially sign off on the property tax exemption for it to take effect. It does place the administrative requirements and oversight of the exemption program and everything primarily with the city or the county that passes the ordinance or the resolution. And it does require an annual application to the city or the county from the property owner. It sunsets the initial year of the exemption of qualification January 2nd, 2027. So, of course, if you qualify before that and you still have up to that 10-year period, that exemption would remain for the remainder of that period. But it's just the new applications for exemption that would sunset January 2nd, 2027.
Thank you. Representative, thank you.
Chair Barnhart, committee, thank you for hearing this bill. As you can see in all this, it has broad bipartisan support. We've been working on it for quite some time. this thought came to me when I was still a county commissioner looking at countywide enterprise zones and the good work of Representative Smith many years ago. And we could never have too many tools in our toolbox, so to speak, to look at the affordable housing issues that we have around the state. As it was explained in the short narrative, the bill allows a unit of local government to work with any developer on a multifamily housing project to really come to the unit of local government ahead of time, knowing what the current assessed value of the property is, what the project completion assessed value would be. The unit of local government would then, of course, know how many units the project would yield, and they could negotiate how many of those units would be would fall into the average median income and or affordable workforce housing scenario that is outlined in the bill. This is such that it really, I know that there's other housing programs available. This is really not site specific, only that, of course, the land must be zoned for the housing, whereas other, of course, affordable housing techniques are more site specific and have more restrictions. This really gives local government the ability to deal with the workforce or affordable housing within their jurisdiction and gives them the authority to do so, utilizing the abatement of the taxes associated with the reassessed value of the property. That is it in a nutshell, Mr. Chair. And I really, again, as I started this conversation, this is just another tool in the toolbox. What I like about it for rural Oregon, for example, is just as in the metro area or more populated centers in our state, we have affordable housing issues. More importantly, on the coast, Curry County, for example, 30% of the properties owned in Curry County are owned by people that don't live in Curry County. And so when it comes to building multi-unit housing, one could argue that it's less expensive to build multi-unit housing in Curry County versus the multi-unit housing in Washington County. The cost of doing business is higher in Washington County than it is in Curry County, and the taxes might be higher in Washington County than they would be in Curry County. But I want to explain how it's relative, because the average median income in Curry County is far less than it is in Washington County. So I want to say it gives a level playing field across the state, not being site-specific to affordable housing being built anywhere. There's no reason why a developer wouldn't want to invest in an apartment complex in Brookings, Oregon, to build affordable housing, because they'll be able to negotiate the return, allow the with the unit of local government, then in this case it would be the city of Brookings, and be able to do so and generate the revenues that they would if they were in Washington County. So everything is, it's an equal relative matrix, I would say.
Very good.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. So we have, I know that Representative Brock Smith has worked with the assessors on the bill a little bit, and that some changes have been made. Those are reflected in the A engrossed version. The department did have a couple of additional concerns that we didn't catch in the policy committee. The bill requires that the units be affordable to households at 80% of the average median income, and then it delegates to the cities or local jurisdictions who are adopting the ordinances that they will define what area median income is. But we think that they also should define what affordable means. Typically in the literature, when you talk about affordable housing, it's 30% of gross income or something along those lines. And so you could put it in the bill, or you could just delegate that the city or county will define what affordable actually means. Kind of along those lines, the way that the bill contemplates looking at that the rental units are affordable, it just kind of sets that affordability based off of the average household size, and that then it looks at their income and makes sure that that's 80% of the area median. So when you think about a multifamily development, though, they typically have units of various sizes. And so there should be some flexibility in the bill or a requirement that the cities look at, you know, what is the affordable rent on a studio compared to the affordable rent on a two or three bedroom. And that's actually not contemplated in the bill right now, but that I think would be, you know, something that we could work on some language on and get fixed up. Finally, the last thing, and it's really a policy question for y'all, and that is the bill only says that the units must be affordable to folks in that income category, but it doesn't say that the units actually have to be occupied by them. So what you could end up with is a very inexpensive unit that is occupied by somebody with a pretty high income. And so that's a policy question. You could go either direction on that one, but if the intent is to only have it occupied by people who meet these income restrictions, then that should be laid out a little bit more clearly in the bill.
And I'm working, Mr. Chair, I'm working with DOR on these three issues. My focus, having come from local government, is to give local government the ability, or as much ability as that we can, to address the first two issues with regards to rental size and or unit size and the affordable rates to the cities. And then, of course, we want to make sure that the units are also tied to income. And so I'll be working with DOR on that last point as well.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. Thank you, Representative, for the bill. Is there a definition of eligible rental property? We know what you have, and I ask that question because I don't have a great deal of multifamily property in my district, but I have a lot of single-family rental units and so forth. Is there a statutory definition of eligible rental? And maybe the department knows that better, just to know what's in view here.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. Again, the question is the definition for multifamily housing.
It's the same.
No, that's the question. I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear.
Could single family be eligible rental property if it's a rental and not an owner occupied? Would that fit in here? Are we strictly talking about multifamily property?
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, for this bill it is multifamily only. So okay. It says eligible rental property means newly rehabilitated or constructed multi-unit rental housing.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Add on to that, Representative Johnson, it's not specified to tie to the statute in the bill, but in 308701, that's defined as residential property consisting of four or more dwelling units and not included assisted living facilities.
Okay.
So that could certainly be, four person or four.
Four flex and a, okay. Thank
yeah,
you.
Four more dwelling units. So that could be tied to that definition in language changes.
Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I do understand that the plight though that you bring up.
Mm-hmm.
I did look at it in this bill and adding it, and it took the bill from 4 pages to 12, and it opened up many more cans of worms with regards to how to structure that. Give the abatement to the property owner.
Okay.
But I'm open to any amendments that you, mm-hmm. If we can figure out how.
Okay. Representative Barsh.
Thank you, Chair. Rep. Brock-Smith, thank you for bringing this forward. I know how hard you've worked on it. So I appreciate the form that the bill is in maybe next to final form. I have a question for staff. Do we have any precedent in any of our property tax exemptions for separating out that portion of the property tax that goes to schools and providing an exemption on the balance?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, I know that there was a bill this session that contemplated that.
Mm-hmm.
Administratively, that would be a pretty complex effort, actually, because what you would have to do is you'd have to split every property into
one and the other.
Multiple code areas, I think, is how I've understood from the assessors. But I know that there was some concern when that bill dropped that would add quite a bit of administrative difficulty to the system. But the idea has been contemplated. I don't know if you have anything.
Yeah, Representative Marsh, there are instances where, I don't know if it's specific to schools, but certainly I believe it's the vertical housing development zone allows special districts the ability to opt in or out. And that's certainly the concern that it's administratively difficult definitely comes up, but that is under current law, so there are some instances of that where you do allow specific districts to opt in or out, yes. Okay.
And Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, that vertical housing development zone is considered to be one of the most difficult exemptions for the assessors to administer. So if I didn't say that, I'd be tarred and feathered at the next assessor's convention. So
you did get a big grin from one of them just now.
Chair Barnhart,
yes.
Representative Marsh, I want to thank you for all of your help on this piece of legislation. As Representative Marsh is a few doors down from my office, and we're here late. There's been many a times that I've been in her office, and I've been upwards of 8 o'clock at night talking about this legislation and going over the ins and outs, so, and others. So thank you.
Other question? It looks to me as though this bill really has only a couple of sideboards. It appears to me as though the city or county can grant a property tax exemption by ordinance without reference to the other taxing entities. Is that right? Is that correct, or have I missed that somehow?
They need 51% of the other taxing entities.
Just point for me where that shows up in the bill. I've just simply missed it.
Section 1.5.
Page 2, line 13.
Oh, okay, there it is. All right. And I think it would be helpful to understand how this bill supplements the laws we already have on low-cost housing. So many of these things come through our committee, and it feels to me as though this is a redundancy. It probably isn't, but it sure looks an awful lot like a number of the other bills that we've already considered. Perhaps we could. I don't expect an answer today, but perhaps you could work that up for us a little bit. Okay. We have some other witnesses to hear from. Any other questions? Thank you so much. Appreciate it very much. And I assume that the two of you are working together on the issues that the department raises.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, thanks. Aaron Doyle, John Chandler, Stacy Mickelson. He probably didn't hear me. Oh, there he comes.
Oh, he hears fine. He's just slow on the uptake.
Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. And I kind of want to get to your last question first, since the bill's been pretty well explained. We, of course, support this bill as it's a local option. But in looking at, I'm not Wendy, so I'm not as expert in the property tax abatement and exemptions programs as you're probably used to, but I've looked at just the overview of the other multifamily-oriented property tax exemption programs, and it seems that the vast majority of them seem to focus or are directed at areas that are urban core or transit areas or other sorts of access to services, putting mm-hmm. density close to those types of transportation services. And then vertical housing development zones is focused more towards market rate, mixed use development. So there are different programs, but they have very different and oftentimes more rigorous sets of circumstances that have to be met in order for the property to qualify for that property tax exemption, like transit access or distressed areas. Or areas where the properties primarily are not built to code any longer. There's a variety of those tax exemptions, but none of them quite hit the broadness that this does. The other difference that I would say with this bill from some of those other multi-unit exemption programs is that schedule that was talked about in the description, where it's your units get you the number of years and get your rate, which is, I think, a new and creative way of kind of looking at this to give both the flexibility to the local government to get what they need as far as low-income housing comes across, but also to get developers, give them the ability to kind of do their price setting, their expectation of rental income after they've developed the property, and set aside the number of units that balances out on that schedule for their development costs. So I think that those are some of the key differences between what's proposed in this bill and what currently exists in law. I'm happy to hear that we're working on the definition of affordable being placed somewhere in law. Primarily, I focus on land use and housing, and affordable is a term that we kick around, and my cities are like, what does affordable mean? And I look around, and there's no real good definition in statute, but we all know that it means 30% of the family's income. I think that will be an excellent addition. It'll help our cities as they're looking at what price points they really are talking about. The final thing I'll say is that this bill provides us a flexible tool to kind of manage how multifamily is built in areas where we're maybe not getting as much, and we want to incentivize some of it to be done, but we also want to incentivize it to be done so that not every unit is being rented out at a rate that's only affordable to the highest income earners in an area. So we can use this to flex in areas that aren't as large as Portland or Washington County, where they have the ability to access some of these other tools that maybe this tool will provide that for other areas of the state. And I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Let's hear from the others, and then we'll go to questions.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacey Michelson with the Association of Oregon Counties, here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2377. Just for a bit of history, AOC recently created a housing subcommittee of our Community and Economic Development Committee, and that arose from our commissioners recognizing that housing really was an issue that every one of our members was facing, not just our folks in the metro area, but even our Eastern Oregon or more rural Oregon folks were struggling with issues of availability or adequacy of housing in their area. So we put together a subcommittee, and our folks have been sort of puzzling through where counties can best engage in the housing conversation, recognizing that most of the policy that's going to drive local development really does come from our partners at the city level. But this was one bill that went through our subcommittee that our folks were pretty excited about and felt like we could really sink our teeth into. Particularly appreciated that Rep. Brock Smith was talking about this even when he was back at the commissioner level. It was something he'd been thinking about for quite some time. And as Aaron's mentioned, you know, for our folks, it really is about that local control, local option. Recognize, you know, it is likely that cities would be more apt to use this than our counties would, but it still gives us another option to work with, something to consider. We've got some of our members here from our coastal communities. That's one area where, you know, in particular, we hear about many issues of workforce housing and shortages. You know, so this is an option where, as Aaron mentioned, with a particular number of units dedicated toward affordable housing, you know, it's sort of a nice carrot for developers to come in and potentially work on, you know, larger complexes where they still may be getting the revenue from tourism, et cetera, that they need, but we can also build in some workforce housing there. It's just one brief example of how that may look in some of our communities, but is an example of one reason why we would support that, and we'd love to see 2377 pass. And we appreciate all the work that Rep. Brock Smith has put into modifying the bill and pulling out some of the larger concerns that others had raised. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 2377. And I particularly want to commend Representative Brock Smith for not only a lot of good work putting into this bill, but also for simply recognizing the not just the problem of affordable housing at the local level, because that's pretty well established, but to using his commitment to using the hydraulics of the marketplace to actually deliver it. Too often, and Mr. Chair, you mentioned a variety of other bills that have come through, oftentimes those are simply go-dos. We tell the cities or the counties go do, and we don't necessarily engage on how that's going to work out, how the market's going to respond, how people that are in my client's business of building housing as a business venture are going to respond to it, and consequently a lot of those go-dos don't actually get much done. This bill, it still needs some work perhaps, but the notion that that would encourage a developer to sit down with the city or county and actually run the numbers. What would it take to make a pencil to do the affordable housing? Here's the carrots, here's the sticks. I think that makes a lot of sense. And whether it would produce gobs of units or not, I'm frankly less concerned with it. I think it would. But I'm more interested in the model it creates. If this works at the, particularly in a smaller city or smaller jurisdiction, is pretty manageable. If they can make it crank, that's something that can be scaled up and taken to larger areas as well. Using, since we're not likely to be dumping a whole bunch of more money into housing this session, using existing resources of the property tax base and credits against that with a willing city or county and a willing developer seems like a very smart idea. The earlier version of the bill in the housing committee did have a single family component as well as a multifamily component. Representative Brock Smith and I have been continuing to talk about that. If the bill progresses, we'd like to try to put that back on the table. It's a little more complicated, of course, for a variety of reasons. But that, if we could figure out how to do that, if the bill by itself is great, let's move it. But if we can figure out how to get the single family piece in there as well, that would, I think, really be an important statement out of this legislative assembly for housing this session. Commend it to you. Be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think first, just a point, I think, to your earlier question about haven't we seen some of these other initiatives before in various fashions in this session, I would say yes, but at least this one doesn't only apply to counties of 750,000 and up. So therein there could be other benefits.
Very good point.
But Mr. Chandler, I wonder if it might be accurate to refer to this as perhaps a kinder, gentler version of inclusionary zoning, in that it puts the developer in the position of going to his or her local governing entity and saying, I'm willing to do this project, I'd like to do this project, and I'm willing to add this affordable housing component in here as a means to help me afford to do a greater project. But it puts the developer in the position of thinking creatively about what he or she could do, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, normally I don't use the phrase inclusionary zoning if I don't have my crucifix and garlic handy. But since you raised it, yeah, exactly. That's it. That is what this is. That's what IZ was supposed to be doing, except that IZ tended to be one of those go-dos that I mentioned. This is actually a let's reason together, if you don't mind a somewhat grandiose way of putting it. And I think we'll have much more. This bill, if it were to pass, which I hope it will have, I believe, have more effect than IZ would, simply because of that reason. It does bring the people that need to be at the table to the table with a joint reason for being there.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony today. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2377. Okay, we're ready on 3453.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Okay, we'll open the work session on House Bill 3453. Kyle, I think that's yours too.
Well, yes.
Yeah, you want to tell us where we are on that one?
Yes, Mr. Chair, House Bill 3453 comes to you without an amendment. It is the introduced version. So just as a reminder, this was the bill making modifications to two existing property tax exemptions. And really what the existing exemptions are is it's relating to providing exemption to property that is owned by a exempt institution and used in an exempt way, but it's being leased. So the two statutes that are being affected is the exempt lease from a taxable owner, so that's taxable owner leasing to an exempt entity, or an exempt owner leasing the property to an exempt entity as well. So those are the two changes, and then the changes, or the actual change in the measure to the underlying statute is, right now under current law, the property tax benefit from not imposing property taxes on this leased property has to be contained within the lease that the nonprofit in many cases is leasing the property from either the taxable or the non-taxable owner. So that reduction reflective of the property taxes that are not being paid has to be included in that lease. That language is removed from statute and replaced by language that requires the property tax benefit to inure solely to the exempt entity that is leasing the property. So the committee heard testimony on how this exactly would work, and it'd probably be contained within the lease document of just providing that property tax reduction right to the lessee in that case. And we do have the fiscal, there's no fiscal, and the revenue impact is just minimal in that this could actually potentially reduce some of the administrative barrier proving the property tax benefit is contained within the lease. So we could see a few properties in the small scale of qualifying for this exemption that don't today just because they can't get essentially the paperwork and the mechanics together. But it is a minimal.
Okay. Are we ready?
Ready.
Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3453 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 3453 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion?
I'm sorry.
There, it is discussion. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. I do want to go on record as having some misgivings about this. I think it's very difficult once you take out some of the specifics that were complex to organize to prove that the benefits of this are going through to the people that it is intended to benefit. I think that's the tension between making things simpler and making sure that they actually achieve what we want them to. We've taken out the language that mandates and put in some pretty loose language around the tax assessor's ability to challenge these kind of things. I hope we don't come to regret this.
Yeah, I completely concur.
Well, in spite of that, do you have an expectation to object to the motion?
I do.
Because if you do, we'll have to hold it over till we have more members here. All right. Thank you very much. With that, Representative Benz, will you withdraw your motion?
Happy to.
Thank you. Representative Benz withdraws his motion. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3453. Colleagues, I don't know that I've said this, but the other two matters that are before us today, House Bill 3260 and House Bill 2047, are not yet ready, and I'm holding them over until tomorrow. Stand by for further news on those two measures. And we will also hold over till tomorrow House Bill 3453 in hopes that more of our members are here instead of wherever it is they are. Paul, have I accounted for all the bills? I have. Thank you. With that, we'll committee. I will simply note that tomorrow, according to the speaker's notice, we're only going to have a short meeting because of floor at 2:00, and so I urge everyone to be on time at 1:00 tomorrow for the work we have to do then. And with that, thank you, and we are adjourned.